Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hi, this week on Living Planet, is Sudan cursed with oil?
The future is the resource curse idea in both Sudan and South Sudan is going to play out in these negotiations.
As South Sudan and its northern neighbour resume revenue sharing talks, we look at the role of oil in their conflict. We'll also look at fracking in the United States and in Austria.
There's enough gas to supply this country for my kids and my kids' kids.
There are a lot of questions about whether drinking water is also being contaminated by this fracking fluid.
We are not using this mix of various chemicals anymore. So it's definitely a clean process what we are using, and we are having zero environmental impact.
And a molecule to cool the planet. Is its recent discovery good news for the climate?
What it is potentially saying is that the ecosystem is working harder than we first thought to combat climate change.
Those stories coming up. I'm Nathan Woodcop. Welcome to the show. This week, Sudan and South Sudan resumed talks on sharing the proceeds of oil revenues. After decades of intermittent war, South Sudan gained formal independence from its northern neighbour last year. It inherited most of Sudan's oil, but it's not clear how the two countries should split the revenues. Many observers fear that if a fair and transparent agreement isn't reached soon, the two sides are destined to resume fighting. I asked Dana Wilkins from the campaign group Global Witness, which focuses on corruption in extractive industries, to lay out the problem for me.
They've in fact been negotiating for a year prior to independence on how the oil sector would play out once South Sudan became an independent state. And so far, negotiations have produced almost nothing. In fact, at the moment, the two parties seem almost further apart than ever on how South Sudan will be using the infrastructure in Sudan to export its oil.
And what's so complex about this? I thought that they had some kind of basic agreement that they would split oil 50-50.
The agreement to split the oil 50-50 ended on July 9th. And since then, South Sudan, which has what was previously three-quarters of Sudan's oil in its territory, needs to use the infrastructure that's in Sudan, so the processing facilities, the refineries, the port of export, and the pipelines to export its oil and get revenues from it.
So it's not a matter of they can just draw a line and be independently responsible for selling their own oil?
No, certainly not. And tangentially, Sudan is heavily reliant on, or was heavily reliant on, South Sudan's oil revenues prior to independence, and there's a huge gap in its economy now from the loss of those revenues.
Well, maybe we can get some quick facts here. How much is oil worth to these countries in terms of billions of dollars and as a proportion of their respective governments' revenues?
Well, I think in terms of like actual monetary value, it's difficult to know right now because a new deal hasn't been agreed yet. But percentage-wise, prior to independence, oil revenues represented 98% of the budget in South Sudan. And southern oil revenues represented about 25 to 30% of the Sudanese economy.
And so what would a fair deal look like from your perspective?
I mean, it's tricky for me to say. It's very much up to the negotiating parties to determine the structure of the deal. But how it appears to be playing out is a commercial arrangement. So divorcing the political issues such as ownership of Abyei, the status of other border regions, and citizenship issues. It's looking as though it will be a sort of transit fee agreement, so South Sudan can use the pipelines and infrastructure for a set fee, which South Sudan's proposing an international standard of less than a dollar a barrel, whereas Sudan is requesting something like $36 a barrel is the most recent request. And then South Sudan's also offered a sort of transitional financial arrangement where instead of giving these higher fees, they also provide several billion dollars of grants over a four-year period.
And I'm wondering, how central is oil to the conflict between these two countries? Is it central or is it incidental?
No, oil is the single most likely trigger for war, no question about it. Because both economies rely so heavily on oil, and a stop in exports could mean tremendous financial costs for both and for the companies, so it would also impact their investor relations. This is a quite incendiary issue.
And who buys Sudan's oil? Is it possible that customers could weigh in here, or is that kind of naive?
No, in fact, customers are weighing in here. So if you're talking about the biggest export destination, China, Chinese officials have, since the start of the year, and in fact immediately prior to the start of the year when there was also another sort of threatened blockade, Chinese officials had made quite strong statements encouraging both parties to resolve the issues in a calm way and not risk impeding the export further.
Your organization is very much concerned about transparency in the extractive industries. Mm-hmm. A lot of oil-rich Gulf states aren't transparent about their oil revenues, but their citizens enjoy low or no taxes and subsidized housing and education. Is it that important?
Well, it's very important. You're talking about a very different political context. If you're looking just at South Sudan, for example, you're talking about the world's newest and most oil-dependent state, where even basic infrastructure is lacking and the government struggling to provide basic services for its people. Now more than ever, it's critical that the government, you know, makes a strong democratic stand for this transparency and good governance and ensures that its people receive the full benefits from its natural resources.
Do you think Sudan's a classic example of a country that's been cursed with valuable resources, in this case, oil?
In the past, during certain instances, yes, you can make the case for that. However, I think the future is the resource curse idea in both Sudan and South Sudan is going to play out in these negotiations. It's wholly dependent on how these negotiations play out and then how the two governments then manage their independent sectors.
So this week, negotiators are meeting again to try and work out a deal. Where do things go from now? Are we expecting weeks of negotiations?
They'll probably be together in Addis for another week's time. What's concerning me is that I suppose we knew going into it, it was very unlikely that they would have a final deal agreed during this time period, but they might not even have a transitional one or an interim one, which with the tankers being stopped in Port Sudan and diversion of oil to refineries and companies stepping up saying they won't participate in this sort of illegal loading, quite dangerous that the two parties aren't sitting down in earnest and hashing out at least an interim deal.
Thank you very much for speaking to us today. That's Dana Wilkins from the campaign group Global Witness, which focuses on corruption in extractive industries. Thanks for coming on the show.
No, thank you.
And a reminder, you're listening to Living Planet, coming to you from Bonn in Germany. To our main focus today, fracking. With the dangers of nuclear power playing out in Japan, tensions in the Middle East pushing up oil prices, and climate scientists arguing for the phase-out of coal, the United States is desperate for some energy alternatives. One that has seemed promising in recent years is natural gas. It burns more cleanly than coal. With demand for gas driving up the price, hard-to-reach deposits have become lucrative, and that has led to a boom in fracking to get them. It's a technique whose proponents say is vital for cleaner, stable energy, and whose detractors say is an environmental and health risk. Sandy Houseman went to Southwest Virginia to find out why.
Widespread fears about hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, began with a low-budget documentary called Gasland, in which a young man from Pennsylvania gets an offer to sell gas drilling rights on his land. He does some research to find out what would be involved, and is alarmed when he visits a Colorado home near several gas wells. The owner turns on his kitchen tap, flicks his cigarette lighter, and jumps back as the water bursts into flame.
We'll just give it a second here. Whoa! I smell hair!
Oh, damn!
It was a dramatic way for filmmaker Josh Fox to get the public's attention. He then went on to make a frightening case against fracking. You can see how fracking is done in Southwest Virginia, where gas is trapped in pockets of rock. About 30 men have come to drill a well and shoot a mix of liquid and sand into the ground. The force of that fluid cracks the rock and frees the gas, which is then captured and sent to market by pipeline.
There's enough gas to supply this country for my kids and my kids' kids.
That's Greg Cozera, president of the Virginia Oil and Gas Association. He's pretty excited because part of this state sits on the Marcellus Shale, a deep rock formation that extends north through West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York. It's the second largest gas field in the world, and some experts say it could meet America's energy needs for 100 years. Cozera insists gas can be extracted safely. He saw Gasland and checked a map for one of the other places featured, Dimock, Pennsylvania.
Just north of Dimock, it was Salt Springs State Park. So I picked up the phone and I called their 800 number and I said, tell me about your park. How'd you get the name? She says, we got these natural salt springs. And she said, they're fed by the natural methane in the rocks.
And if weather conditions are right, she said, you can actually set the springs on fire. After Gasland's release, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission checked on the original flaming tap water and concluded it came from a well drilled into a naturally occurring gas pocket. But that doesn't comfort Sarah Francisco, a senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center.
There have been fairly well-documented instances where people's drinking water wells have been contaminated by methane gas that's leaked from these wells. And there are a lot of questions about whether drinking water is also being contaminated by this fracking fluid.
That fluid may contain cancer-causing chemicals, highly corrosive salts, and radioactive elements from underground. When it returns to the surface, this toxic soup is sometimes kept in storage ponds.
There have been concerns about these pits flooding over or leaking and contaminating rivers and streams. Sometimes the material is just sprayed out across the ground. It's been known to, you know, kill vegetation where it's been sprayed, or it may be taken to a sewage treatment plant.
Sewage treatment plants are not equipped to remove the chemicals or radioactive pollutants in fracking fluid, so the stuff had been dumped into rivers. And communities downstream, like Pittsburgh, ended up with drinking water that didn't meet federal safety standards. Virginia's Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy feels confident fracking itself is safe and unlikely to contaminate drinking water.
Just due to the very nature of the drilling, the fact they're going so deep that they are thousands of feet well below the water zones when they do the fracturing, it's impossible for that material to get back up into the aquifer.
Spokesman Mike Abbott adds that chemicals are unlikely to leak from wells that are properly lined.
We have a very robust program of casing the well. We require three casings put into the well. Those casings go down over 300 feet below the closest or deepest water aquifer. And then those casings are also concreted back to the surface. This protects the water zone.
But he concedes that accidents happen, and the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington is conducting its own investigation into the possible hazards of fracking. In addition to water pollution, the EPA will consider another possible risk as more companies begin using this technology to extract gas from the ground. States that have not reported earthquakes in decades, Ohio, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kansas, Colorado, and Virginia, have been shaken by quakes that registered up to 5.6 on the Richter scale. Geologists believe there may be a connection, and some wells have been shut down. Sandy Hausman, Deutsche Welle Radio, Abingdon, Virginia.
It's not just North Americans who are keen on fracking. There's a boom in the technique happening around the world. Here in Europe, many countries are concerned about the reliability of the region's main gas supplier, Russia, and fracking allows them to reconsider their own real estate for previously useless deposits. In Austria, proponents claim to have developed a cleaner method of fracking, but it still divides the community. Kerry Skyring reports from the northern Austrian town of Herrnbaumgarten.
Nein, nur Kaffee, danke schön. Super. Ach,
geht schon. Cafe Prince is the only place open when I arrive in Herrnbaumgarten. And as the locals gather for coffee and wine, it's not difficult to get them talking about drilling for gas and fracking.
It's obvious that we have to do something for the future. It's not for us, it's for the children. But what's missing here is clarification.
Opinions range from skepticism to outright opposition.
It's said
that it will bring jobs, but that's not correct. They'll start boring and we'll get nothing from it except the danger and everything else it brings.
According to Austria's oil giant OMV, the residents of this town and the farms around it are sitting on enough natural gas to meet all of the country's needs for three decades. In one of Austria's poorest regions, that could mean a big boost to the economy. Yet even the mayor of Herrn Baumgarten, Christian Frank, is cautious.
Fracking is a Begriff, der aus den USA nach Europa gekommen ist.
Fracking is a term that has come to Europe from the United States. It's certainly not an exemplary technology, and it has certainly had bad effects on the environment there. So the concept has a negative connotation. OMV is talking to us about clean fracking, in which no chemicals are to be used. What's still to be tested are the other risks.
Zu prüfen bleibt noch, wo die anderen Umweltrisiken liegen werden.
A wine grape farmer oft to tend his vines. This area is known as the Weinviertel, the wine quarter, and produces some of Austria's best wine. The gas lies trapped in rock between 4 and 6 kilometers below these rolling hills. Hydraulic fracturing of the rock is the only way to release and extract it. This involves pumping in millions of liters of water and chemicals under high pressure. In the United States, that's led to groundwater pollution. Professor Herbert Hofstetter from Austria's Montana University says he's working on a new method of fracking.
Basically, the difference is that we are not using this mix of various chemicals anymore. So it's definitely a clean process what we are using, and we are having definitely zero environmental impact. So this is the difference to the existing technology.
US companies such as Halliburton are also working on so-called clean fracking, but little is known about their progress or just how clean it is. And Herbert Hofstetter admits his technology is not yet ready.
We have been working for more than 2 years now on this new fracturing technology, and the lab tests are still ongoing. However, we don't have the final results right now. In a way, the first results we are having, they are very, very promising indeed.
The Weinviertel is already a major producer of energy, wind energy. Massive wind towers are springing up between the vineyards. As I stand beside one on a hill near Herrn Baumgarten, about the only sound is the soft swish of its blades. Helena Waldner moved here from Vienna a couple of years ago. She came for the rural peace and beauty. Now, she's leading a local campaign to stop the shale gas project. She doesn't believe in clean fracking.
That's a clever strategy developed by the marketing department at OMV. It's a method that absolutely does not exist. It's called clean fracking, but that doesn't mean it's clean.
Das heißt aber noch lange nicht, dass das clean ist.
Along with locals like Helena, environmental organizations such as Greenpeace and Global 2000 are against exploiting the natural gas reserves under the Weinviertel. Johannes Wallmüller is an energy expert from Global 2000 and says even if the so-called clean fracking process is used, he would not support it.
No, we wouldn't support it. But it's also not what they stated until now, because they stated they want to develop it, but they didn't say that they would exclude chemicals at all. They just try to exclude it.
The Austrian government is divided over fracking. The environment minister opposes any form of it. But the economy minister says, let's see what the technology can do. Mayor Christian Frank is largely relying on the big petroleum company to do the right thing.
The OMV assures us they will use an ecologically sound system, one that's not yet complete, at least in the details. And the next step is the Environment Ministry will have to issue a permit, and then we will see how the process goes. For us, the most important thing is that neither people nor animals are damaged.
That will be difficult to guarantee. Fracking is known to have caused small earthquakes in both the United States and the United Kingdom. But petroleum industry expert Herbert Hofstetter says the risks of tremors are low.
We have carried out in our industry hundreds of fracturing tests, and there haven't been any report on this. So I don't really see a reason why we should be shy to implement this technology in the future. Actually, the risk is almost close by to zero.
But even if there was no risk, people like Helena believe fossil fuels, especially difficult-to-reach fuels like shale gas, should stay in the ground.
Es gibt viel Unterstützung.
There is a lot of support, especially from the renewable energy industry, which is where we want to be going. We want to again control our own energy production in our region, determining our own future.
The government is yet to decide on whether OMV can drill. The company is 30% state-owned and influential. The idea of reducing dependency on imported gas from Russia and Central Asia will also have great appeal. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Herren Baumgarten in the northeast of Austria.
Time now for some environment news from the past week. Here's Sarus Farivar.
Eco News.
The future of the world's time is to be decided this week at a UN telecom meeting in Switzerland. Governments are divided over whether to abolish the leap second. For 40 years, it's kept computers in sync with the Earth's day. It means telephone companies, financial markets, and air traffic operators need to stop their machines for a heartbeat every year or two. Without it, atomic clocks would, very gradually, overtake solar time. Leap second critics, including nations like the United States and France, want to dispense with the inefficiency. Proponents, including China and Britain, say it's important for astronomers. Without the leap second, atomic clocks would say it is midday at sunrise after many thousands of years. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon launched an initiative on Monday, designating 2012 as the year for sustainable energy for all. The plan has three goals to achieve by 2030. It aims to provide universal access to modern energy services, to double the rate of improvement of energy efficiency, and to double the share of renewable energies worldwide. Meanwhile, the oil giant BP calculates that renewable energies, excluding hydropower, will meet only 5% of the globe's supply by 2030. In an energy report this week, the company said fossil fuels would remain critical sources of power, despite an expected fourfold expansion of clean energies like wind and solar. By 2030, BP expects coal to meet a quarter of energy needs and demand for natural gas to soar. It said the increase in CO2 emissions would rise well above what science says is needed to avoid dangerous climate change. And finally, the German chemical giant BASF said this week it would stop developing genetically modified products for Europe due to long-standing opposition to the technology on the continent. The company said it would relocate the headquarters of its crop science division from Germany to North Carolina in the United States. BASF said it would stop cultivation of its Amflora potato, designed to provide industrial starches. In 2010, Amflora became the first genetically modified plant approved in the European Union in 12 years.
That was Sarus Farivar with the environment news. And if you're looking for more of our environment content, you can find it on the website. That's dwworld.de/environment. Could the planet be working harder than previously thought to naturally mitigate climate change? It's a question that's intriguing an international research team, which recently discovered a molecule first hypothesized in the 1950s. The naturally occurring compound is part of a class of molecules that help break down pollution and turn it, eventually, into clouds that may help cool the planet. To find out more about the discovery, published in Science magazine last week, I spoke to one of the researchers on the project, Dr. Carl Percival, reader in atmospheric chemistry at the University of Manchester. I asked him to describe what he'd helped discover.
What we've detected is a thing called the Krieger radical, and this is a molecule where we've snapped parts off the molecule off, and in particular that makes it unstable. It's a bit like the Jenga games that you get. You pull one brick off and it becomes unstable. You pull two off them and it will fall apart quite quickly. So these are really highly reactive species that are present in the atmosphere naturally.
And so when you say species, it's an organism?
No, sorry. This is unfortunately the chemist's loose language there. It is basically a molecule.
Okay. And what do these Krieger biradicals do that's so interesting?
Well, we've thought that they've been around for quite some time. It was Rudolf Krieger from Germany who first postulated them back in the 1950s, I believe. And we've always known that they're present in the atmosphere, but we've not been able to detect them until now. So what we've been able to do in the work we carried out in collaboration with Sandia and Bristol is we've actually been able to generate them and detect them for the first time. And the key thing that we found here is that they react a lot faster than we previously thought.
Okay, so they've always been around, and now you've been able to identify them. What does this have to do with our climate, though? What implications does this have?
So if we take this story in terms of the sulfur dioxide, which is present in the atmosphere, what we've found here is that the Krieger radical will enhance the oxidation, so it basically transforms it in the atmosphere, and it could eventually lead to the formation of something called sulfate. And this is an aerosol, and sulfate aerosols are known to be a global cooling aerosol.
Right, so the Krieger biradicals could potentially... if I'm going to stretch this, the implications here, does that mean that they could potentially be a way of seeding clouds?
I think, in effect, so people know that people have done lots of research into terms of sulfate, and they are known to act as cloud condensation nuclei, i.e. seeds for clouds, yes. So what we're seeing here is the fact that we've enhanced the formation of these sulfate aerosol, so potentially, I'm not emphasising, potentially, there could be a enhancement in the cloud formation, yes.
There's a potential here for scientists in the lab to artificially create these bioradicals to encourage clouds?
No. In terms of geoengineering, I think it's a non-starter, and I don't think it's possible. Basically, we can't make many of them. As soon as we make them, they fall apart. So we can't make like a bucket of them and put them into the atmosphere. It's impossible to do that one. However, it is potentially a natural response from the biosphere, because all of these alkenes where they're produced from in the atmosphere, 90% of them come from the biosphere. So it is potentially a feedback between climate and the biosphere.
So we often hear of worrying things in terms of melting Arctic ice or the release of methane hydrates. This, you're saying, is a potentially, well, beneficial feedback from our point of view.
Yes, it could well be. I mean, we've only studied like a few reactions of them, and we've got to look at the huge plethora of other reactions that could potentially happen out there to put hand on heart and say that is the case. But at the moment, it's looking quite exciting that we could get this potential feedback with good feedback.
So that would mean, essentially, the more the planet warms, the more clouds will be seeded?
It could be. However, what isn't known really well is the response between the plants and their emissions of these alkene species. So we know that they are released, but do the emissions go up when the temperature increases? There is some evidence to say that. However, at the moment, we do not know. So all we know is that there is this potential feedback, and we need to do further work into it to really nail it down and understand what's going on.
And isn't it the case that clouds can have both a cooling and a warming effect on the planet, depending on different situations?
Yes, it will depend on the situation, and particularly if you look at aerosol as well. There is one of the biggest uncertainties in climate change. We really don't understand what's going on, and a lot of work throughout the globe is focusing on looking at how aerosols are formed, and do they reflect radiation back out into space or cooling, or do they absorb it? It depends on the chemical nature of these aerosols as to what happens there.
But you pretty much rule out the applications for this for geoengineering projects.
Absolutely, yes. At the moment, we just can't do it, and we just can't make enough of it to do that one, and we've only done a couple of reactions as well. So from a geoengineering point of view, I think it's a non-starter.
So what's exciting you now? Where are you going to take this research going ahead?
So, I mean, we're so excited that we've actually seen it for the first time, which is fantastic. And we've only seen one of these particular Krieger radicals. So what we've got to do now, and we are doing, in fact, and we've just done some work, is looked at other types of Krieger radicals. And in particular, what we really want to do is look at ones that can only specifically come from the biosphere. So really look at their reactors fast as well. The other ones that are out in the atmosphere, do they react in the same way? Do they have this potential enhancing effect in terms of sulfate formation too?
And if they do, what does that mean?
We'll have to wait and see. At the moment, we have no idea what the reactivity will be, but if they do end up being as fast as reacting as this one is, what it is potentially saying is that the ecosystem is working harder than we first thought to combat climate change. However, we have to check all the different reactivity before we can say that for sure.
Dr. Carl Percival, reader in atmospheric chemistry at the University of Manchester. Thanks for speaking to us today.
Thank you very much.
And that's all for this week. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to leave comments for the show, you can write to us at livingplanet, that's one word, at dw-world.de. Till next week, I'm Nathan Woodcock. Bye for now. Ich bin hier, weil ich